educating the masses with God's Word, Truth, and Facts. Wade Through the Swamp with Rick on For God and Country.
Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. You just heard For God and Country with Rick Lawson. Stay tuned. More to come.
All right. Hey, guys. Today we're going to start out with talking about the Second Amendment. I believe you just heard it. Shall not be infringed. The reason why I put that up is throughout this podcast, I plan on going deeper and talking about Supreme Court proceedings regarding the Second Amendment, why the Second Amendment was written, why it's number two in the list of our premier rights, God-given rights. Didn't say state-given rights. I didn't say federal government-given rights. I said God-given rights. It's the right of the people to bear arms. And that right shall not be infringed. I don't know what part that you people aren't getting. Anyways, this Mike Robert Lee article looks like it's, I can't see what the, not sure exactly where the article was posted, but it was Mike Robert Lee's article. It was posted on the 22nd, so a couple days ago. It says, the appeal of the California assault weapons ban is on hold after the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals temporarily blocked the federal district court ruling. Basically, that was, a court battle saying that the ban on assault rifles by a specific state is not constitutional, that they don't have the right to do it. Well, apparently in the Ninth District, which is probably an Obama holdover, judge decided that they're not going to rule on this court case yet. Monday, a panel decision in Miller versus Bonta, the court appellate court, put the June 4th order from District Court Judge Roger Benendez on hold as the court awaits the outcome of another case. Benitez ruled that the ban violated the Second Amendment. So, they took it to court, said that the ban violates the Second Amendment. The judge agreed. The judge said it can be overturned. Of course, they went to the Ninth Circuit because until they get their way, they're going to keep pushing. And this judge decides to put it on hold regarding waiting for another case. And hopefully, that will be further on in the article what case they're talking about, because they can't just put things on hold forever. The Supreme Court can't do that either. They can't just refuse to hear cases just because they don't like them when they know they're going to lose. So it looks like this Ninth Appeals Court judge says that they're going to hear the case, but they refuse to report on it or to rule on it. The stay shall remain in effect until, not quite sure what that means. I don't know if that means the ban is postponed and held, or if the overturning of the ban is postponed until the ruling. Maybe the article will give a little more light on that part. I don't know. The Rupp case also deals with the assault weapons ban that has already been briefed before the Ninth Circuit. The case has also been put on hold as the court rules on other Second Amendment cases that could affect the ruling. Benitez District Court ruled that California's assault rifle ban was unconstitutional, arguing that the people had the right to own modern weapons. Benitez compared the popular AR-15 to a Swiss Army knife, saying it's a perfect combination for home and defense weapon, homeland defense equipment, and it is. It's a very solid rifle. It's got very few moving parts. It's no different than a historical weapon, except for it just looks scary. It's got more plastic and more metal on it, and it's black instead of wood. I don't know what makes the libs so afraid of this weapon. But we don't ban cars that go 200 miles an hour because somebody might go 200 miles an hour with them and they might kill somebody. Same thing as we don't sue car manufacturers when somebody does go 200 miles an hour and kill somebody. So you shouldn't be trying to sue a weapons manufacturer because somebody else, some idiot, decided to use their weapon in an inappropriate manner. Under no level of heightened scrutiny can the law survive, Benitez says. That ruling will now have to wait until the resolution of the Rupp case in the Ninth Circuit, telling parties to stand by and issue a status report in 14 days after Rupp's ruling is made. So, you can't put the weapon. So the weapon is still banned until they decide to rule on it 14 days after this other case goes through. I do know that the St. Louis City and St. Louis County have recently filed lawsuits. I'm not sure which district court. I need to do some research to find out what district court they're filing their lawsuits in, because they don't need to be trying to overturn laws that our state government and legislature have created. In other news, Democrats Senator Kyrsten Sinema took aim at her own party by regarding the legislative filibuster, calling Democrats hypocrites and attempting to rid the Senate of the procedure they used themselves several times last year. From the piece, looks like it's from Fox News, Mike Robert Lee. To those who want to eliminate the legislative filibuster and pass the For the People Act voting rights legislation I support and have co-sponsored, I would ask, would it be good for the country if we did only to see legislation rescinded a few years from now and replaced by a nationwide voter ID law or restrictions on voting by voting by mail in federal elections over objections to the minority, Sinema wrote in the Post. This question is less about the immediate results from any of these Democratic or Republican goals, she continued. It's the likelihood of repeated radical reversals in federal policy, cementing uncertainty and deepening divisions, and further eroding Americans' confidence in government. I agree. I think once a bill, if a bill is shot down and it doesn't ever pass, then the main components of the bill should be taken off the table. Once a bill is shot down, you can't keep bringing it back before. You can't bring it back 72 times until you can get it to pass because you happen to get a majority, a congressional majority that you like, instead of a minority, instead of being the minority. Once in a majority, it's tempting to believe that you will stay in the majority, but a Democrat Senate majority used a 60-vote threshold just last year to filibuster a police reform proposal and a COVID relief bill that many Democrats use as inadequate, Sinema wrote. Those filibusters were mounted not as attempts to block progress, but to force continued negotiations toward better solutions. I agree with Ms. Sinema. I think the filibuster is definitely needed, and I don't think that they should remove it. Senate Democrats used filibuster 327 times in 2020.
Wow.
While Republicans only used the procedure once. The filibuster was also unpopular with Trump. Who early in his presidency encouraged then-majority leader Mitch McConnell to eliminate the rule in order to carve a path for his agenda. But McConnell resisted pressure from Trump, keeping the filibuster in place. I agree. I don't think it should go anywhere. I love Trump, but I don't agree with that.
You just heard For God and Country with Rick Lawson. Stay tuned. More to come.
Now, some Democrats say the procedure used 327 times last year is archaic. An archaic Senate rule cannot get in the way of protecting our democracy, said Amy Klobuchar. An archaic rule. I don't believe it's an archaic rule. I think it's necessary, and I think it does a great job. I don't see anything wrong. I believe that was the whole point and purpose. There needs to be some tight restrictions on how laws are passed. You can't have one side. You got one side that's massive, and they're constantly throwing all these bills out there. You got to have somebody with a little more sense to just stay calm, go through the bills, and vote on them accordingly. That's why we have multiple sides pieces of government. On to voting rights. Let's see. From an article by Matt Palumbo. Man, I like that guy. Posted on the 22nd. Poll finds massive support for voter ID and liberal media disinformation campaign. According to the piece, the issue over voter fraud, over voter ID, has proven itself to be one of the most controversial, least controversial policies there is. The most controversial, least controversial. That's interesting. Matt Palumbo, he's a smart dude, that guy. While the media paints the issue of a Republican proposal to disenfranchise minority voters, polling consistently shows that the same minority voters that would supposedly be disenfranchised by a voter ID policy support it. In a world where there's polling on most hot-button issues, it's 50-50 or 45-50, or 55-45 at least, it's a bit puzzling how something has so much, with as much support as voter ID, can be considered remotely controversial. Because if you have to have an ID to vote, then it's a lot harder to cheat. You can't have dead people because you got to have an ID that proves you are the person who's on that piece of paper. Signature verification is the same. If you have to verify who you are, you can't vote multiple times in multiple districts in multiple states. If you got to prove who you are, you can't be dead. You can't vote if you're dead. If you don't have adequate ID, you can't prove you're a United States citizen. And according to our Constitution, the only people allowed to vote are United States citizens. Any state that allows an illegal alien to vote needs to be charged with a federal crime. Any person that registers an illegal alien to vote should be charged with a federal crime and prosecuted. I would call it an insurrection. Their goal is to bring in all these illegals, get them all registered to vote, so they can try to overthrow a democratically elected government. That's an insurrection, isn't it? Isn't that what they said January 7th was? It was an insurrection where all these people screamed and demanded that to be heard, and a few idiots in the crowds broke stuff. That was an insurrection, wasn't it? Just saying. A poll that determined 80% of those polled support requiring photo identification when voting, while only 18% are opposed. 62% of Democrats polled, 87% of independents polled, and 91% of Republicans polled backed requiring photo identification to vote. They also polled on other election-related policies, such as early voting, vote by mail. 71% think early voting should be made earlier, while 16% say it should be made harder. By party, 89% of Democrats support making it easier compared to 56% of Republicans. This is consistent with the fact that historically Democrat presidential candidates have outperformed among those who vote early, while Republicans outperform those who vote on Election Day. I can't see any reason why you shouldn't be able to vote early, but it should be just like it is when you vote. The same rules should apply. I don't care if you vote. I don't care if you decide to have the polls open for a week. I mean, it doesn't really matter to me one way or the other, as long as you have to show ID, and I think you should have to show valid reason why you feel the need to vote by mail if you're going to vote by mail. As long as you can walk into a post office and show your ID, or you know, a bank or a library that happens to have it, as long as it's monitored by polling people, then I see nothing wrong with voting. Drop boxes, unless that drop box has people standing there watching it 24/7, then it's it shouldn't be allowed. You have to have, you know, you think of that vote. I think of my vote, my document, my ballot, rather. I think of it as a stack of $100 bills. When I go to the casino and I see somebody carrying $10,000 in cash, $20,000 in cash, or hell, however much is in the metal carts that they push around that are full of cash, probably a million at least, if they're high bills. Notice they always have an armed guard next to them. When they take possession of this money, they have to sign a document saying how much money is in the box. The box wasn't vandalized, wasn't tampered with. Here's the key. It's locked. It stayed locked on my watch. The armed security guy behind me verified it's locked. Money was not touched until it gets to its place of destination. Your ballot should be just like that. It should be a stack of cash. It's the most valuable thing to you, to anybody. There should be complete, total, without a doubt, security in that from the time you filled it out until the time it was processed. Now, if you run it through the machine yourself, great. Not a problem. Some don't run it through themselves. If you're going to drop it in a drop box, how do you possibly know what the hell's going on with it? Unless an armed security guard with somebody from the polling place watches that as they're pulled out, that they're sealed, that they're completely signed for. They are counted on the spot. The machine should have a counter when they go in. There's 500 go in. There should be 500 coming out. When those ballots go into a polling place, there was 500 going in. There should be 500 in that box or whatever, however they organize it. And then when you sign off that bag package of ballots was open, there was 500. All 500 went through the machine one time, only once. And I believe that there should be cameras. You set it, you open the envelope, you got a camera directly above it. It takes a picture of the front and back of the envelope, a front and picture, front and back of the ballot. If there's any discrepancy, people can watch on both sides. You can have a Democrat and a Republican watching TV monitors, watching every one of those ballots be open when they're opened. If there's a problem, the ballot, whoever's handling those ballots, stops what they're doing, puts their hands in the air, just like at the casino. Somebody walks over and grabs the entire stack, and they can take it to the poll watchers, and the poll watchers can go through them. If there's a discrepancy, work out the discrepancy. That way you're not having to shut down 1,000 votes. If you have 100 in a stack and there's a discrepancy, you pull that 100, stack of 100, you go through it. It's a lot faster. It's a lot easier. And there should be cameras. That way if I've got a ballot, I should have 9 million ballots. I should have 9 million pictures of the front, back, front and back of the envelope that it came in if it's a mail-in vote. And there should be very, very distinct reasons why you can vote by mail. Are you in the military? Are you ill and sickly? Do you have some kind of a valid reason? You don't have a vehicle. You can't get to the polling place. Whatever. Acceptable, valid reasons. Not, oh, well, I might get COVID, or I'm a Democrat, so I should just vote from home. No, don't be lazy. Get your ass up, get your ass to the poll place, and get your ass and vote. I don't think that there should be anybody going around picking up ballots from people. That should be completely and totally illegal in all states. I know a couple of states are allowing it. I disagree completely. They also polled on other election, such as early voting, mail-in voting. 71% they should be made earlier. 16% say it should be made harder. By party of 89% of Democrats, they make it easier compared to 56 Republicans, who this is consistent with historically Democrat president candidates outperforming among those who vote early, while Republicans outperform those who vote on Election Day. Vote by mail was the most controversial and partisan issue polled. 84% of Democrats want it to be easier, only 40% of independents, and only 26% of Republicans. Ironically, this is one of the policies that liberal media portrays as the least controversial. I think it's the most controversial at all of it, but the liberal media are ridiculous. And if you like Matt Palumbo, I think he's a good writer, he's got a few books out. It looks like these are Arthur of Dumb and Dumber, How Cuomo and de Blasio Ruined New York, Debunk This, Shattering Liberal Lies, and Spygate. That's Matt Palumbo. He's a heck of a writer, that guy. If you're going to be checking out books, you need to check out Mark Levin's book. New book coming out. Trying to give a shameless plug, and I can't even think of the name of the book. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. Anyways, you can pre-order it on Amazon. Just type in Mark Levin. I cannot think of the name of it. I guess I need to start putting notes down. And Dan Bongino, he's got quite a few books out. Follow the Money, Spygate. Some good reading for you guys, if that's what you're into. I'm not really a fan of reading. I would much rather have, if it was up to me, I would have books on tape, because I'm lazy, entirely too busy to read. So, what do we have next? Is China desperate to erase evidence? As the coronavirus cover-up is getting uglier, are they trying to delete key information? COVID gene sequencings were deleted from the database. What is that about? We're going to talk about a little coronavirus. A piece from the Daily Caller. Who was the writer? I don't know. Sorry, Daily Caller. I'd be more than happy to... Oh, by Dylan Houseman. Scientists recover deleted Wuhan lab data from NIH database suggesting COVID-19 circulated before the wet market outbreak. Huh. Wonder what that's about. An American scientist obtained deleted data originally from Wuhan University, which indicated COVID-19 was in circulation prior to the outbreak, connected to the Hunan seafood market. Dr. Jesse Bloom, scientist affiliated with the University of Washington, recovered deleted sequences of COVID-19 from early in the pandemic that are genetically more similar to bat coronaviruses than previously known sequences. The data was deleted by the National Institutes of Health from an agency that requests that at the request of Chinese researchers that entered it. Why would they want to delete it? His study could lend more credibility to the theory that COVID-19 was spreading far behind the Hunan wet market outbreak. It also potentially raises new questions about the Chinese lack of transparency. Earlier reports have suggested that initial genetic sequences of COVID-19 were deleted or otherwise hidden from the World Health Organization investigators, from the WHO or investigators. Bloom said he was able to recover files for 31 nearly early virus infections that were deleted from the National Institutes of Health database. The samples were originally submitted as part of a Wuhan University project. The NIH allows science entities to remove samples from their databases via email request. The agency confirmed Thursday that they had deleted the data in line with normal procedures when an entity requests them to do so. Related, exclusive, how the House of Representatives launched COVID-19 origins inquiry asking to grill Fauci. No kidding. That guy needs to go to jail. If all these other people lied to Congress and they got SWAT teams sent to their house at 4 o'clock in the morning, then Fauci should be held accountable. Scientists had been stumped by the fact that the virus sequence collected from the Hunan market were more dissimilar to natural bat coronaviruses than sequences discovered later in the pandemic. In theory, the earliest collected samples should have been the most similar to naturally known viruses, since the proponents of both natural origin theory and lab leak theory tend to agree COVID-19 is a descendant of natural bat-based viruses. Well, we know it is, because they took the virus and they messed with it. They made it more powerful. They made it more... They made it more contagious. And I think they made it more deadly. Those who argue for the lab leak theory have pointed out that the definition of these sequences was possible evidence of a cover-up. Bloom highlights that not only were they deleted from the NIH database, but the project was also removed from the China National Gene Bank shortly after it was removed from the NIH archive. It's interesting. It's very interesting. The discovery also suggests that more untapped data may still be out there for scientists to analyze in order to identify the origin of COVID-19. The Biden administration recently ordered the U.S. intelligence officials to investigate previously unanalyzed data troves that could shed light on the origin of the pandemic. Peter Daszak removed from the UN-backed commission investigating COVID-19 after admitting WIV connections. About time. Elena Chan. Hi, WHO. You might want to still exist in the future. Please reconsider your current trajectory. It's a tweet. I don't know who the person is, but you didn't get an early case data. Sequencing data, not even market data, no bank samples, no patent samples, no paper, just showed bats or penguins in Wuhan markets in 2017 to 19. That's why I don't read tweets on the air. WHO claimed that it was consistent with accepting China's explanation for not having the data. The investigators did not get an early case data, early virus data sequences and patient samples. That's because they failed. They failed miserably. I believe Trump was right when we pulled out of the WHO, and I think the United States need to pull out of the WHO again, because this is beyond ridiculous, guys. Come on now. All right. What do we got? Debunking liberal talking points on guns. It's like we got a David Hersanii. I apologize if I butchered your name, but this relates to my Second Amendment. And I want to give you all the credit I can give you, sir. Judge overturns. The tragically incompetent mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, appeared on CNN's State of the Union recently to deflect attention from the horror show unfolding in her city by blaming interlopers for its spiking murder rate. We're being inundated with guns from states that have virtually no gun control, no background checks, no ban on assault weapons, and it's hurting cities like Chicago. I wonder how many of those crimes are actually taking place with a so-called assault weapon. You can't even give me the definition of a damn assault weapon. It's scary. It's black. You can put a flashlight on it. Watch out. It's a terrible weapon. Although the accusations have been leveled by Chicago politicians for decades now, they are a myth. For one thing, there's no state in the nation with virtually no gun control, no background checks. Every time anyone in the United States purchases a gun from a federal licensee, a gun store, a gun show, it doesn't matter, the seller must run a background check on the buyer through the National Instant Criminal Background Check System database. In some cases, the FFL checks to see if a buyer passed a background check via state-issued conceal and carry permit. In states that allow individuals private sales, it's illegal to knowingly sell to anyone you believe is obtaining the firearm for a criminal purpose. Those who cross state lines to buy guns undergo the same background check, and the sale is processed by an FFL in the buyer's home state. The exact same laws apply to all online sales. The vast majority of Americans obtain their guns in this manner. They rarely commit crimes. Around 7% of criminals in prison bought weapons using their real names. 7%. Fewer than 1% obtain them at gun shows. As the Heritage Foundation, Amy Swearer points out, there have been around 18 million conceal and carry permit holders in the past 15 years. They have committed 801 firearm-related homicides over that span, or somewhere around 0.1%, 0.7% of all firearm-related murders. Concealing carry holders not only are more law-abiding than general population as a group, they're more law-abiding than law enforcement. I couldn't agree more. On top of all this, federal law requires that every FFL license holder report the purchase of two or more handguns by the same person within a week to the Bureau of Tobacco, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. This is one of the reasons for the straw purchase. People with clean record who buy for criminals spread their operations into other states. This is not unique to Illinois or Chicago. It has nothing to do with strict or lenient laws. It has mostly to do with cities failing to prosecute straw purchases. Couldn't agree more. And if they would put people in prison for 25 years for using a gun to commit a crime, guess what? You'd have considerably less gun crime. Once the criminal's put away for 25 years, then they know that they're not going to get away with it again. Then their little brother or sister, they're going to think twice if their big brother's in prison for 25 years because he chose to use a gun in an inappropriate or unsafe manner. Come on, we got more laws on the books than we know what to do with. Why don't we just use the laws that we already have? Lightfoot claims that 60% of the guns used in Chicago murders are bought from out of state. I highly doubt that. I assume she is relying on 2017 suspect gun trace report, which looked at guns confiscated in criminal acts from 2013 to 2016. Even if we trusted the city's data, most of the guns used in Illinois crimes are bought in state. if gun laws in Illinois, which earns a grade of A minus from the pro-gun control Gifford Law Center, tied for second highest in the country after New Jersey. Are more effective than gun laws in Missouri, Wisconsin, or Indiana. Why is it that FL dealers in suburban Cook County are the origin point for one-third of the guns recovered in Chicago and home to 7 of the top 10 source dealers? The only reason it seems criminals take their drive to Indiana is because local gun shops are tapped out. A tremendous demand for weapons in Chicago. Lightfoot might also be surprised to learn that California borders states with liberal gun laws, such as Arizona, Nevada, and Oregon. Yet no big city in California has quite the murder and criminality of Chicago. New York borders on states with liberal gun laws such as Vermont, Pennsylvania, and New Hampshire, yet New York City's murder rate is only a fraction of Chicago's. Texas gets an F from the Gifford Law Center, yet Houston and Dallas have murder rates that are half that of Chicago. The rates in Austin and El Paso are tiny in comparison. Then, of course, the assault weapons bans that Lightfoot brings up have absolutely no bearing on Chicago's murder rate. Even if such prohibitions actually worked, there were 864 murders in the state of Illinois in 2018, the last year which the FBI has full stats. Of homicides were the type of weapon reported by law enforcement. 592 were perpetrated using handguns, 14 with rifles, and 4 with shotguns. Over 100 murders committed using knives or other cutting instruments, hands, feet, and other types of weapons. And of the 14 rifles used, it's surely the case not all of them were assault weapons. In the states of Illinois, you just heard For God and Country with Rick Lawson. Stay tuned, more to come. With no ban on assault rifles, the number of murders committed with a rifle is correspondingly small. 10 in Indiana, 8 in Tennessee, 6 in Kentucky, 4 in Wisconsin, and 3 in Mississippi. Nearly 400 people have already been murdered in Chicago this year, around 100 more than the entire year of 2019. On the night of May 29 through 25, on the night May 29, 25 people were murdered and another 85 wounded by gunfire, more than any other day in 60 years. And yet, mayors appearing on TV blaming Mississippi and Texas, it's far more likely that black market guns find their way to Chicago because the place has been poorly run criminal mecca for decades. It's been run by the mob for decades. I can't fathom the fact that she's blaming her inability to run her. Well, I can, because that's what they do. They're ignorant fools. They're not going to take responsibility for themselves. They're not going to take responsibility for their failures. Because that's just what they are. They're a failure. All right, keeping with the Second Amendment theme of the show, America's failed attempt to ban assault weapons. First of all, do we even know what an assault weapon is? The people trying to ban them can't even describe what they are. They can't give you a definition because then, as Bongino says, and the great one Mark Levin says, if they don't give you a definition what it is, then they have a definition of what it isn't. So if it's got a flashlight mount, If it's got a Picatinny, if it's got a place to put a laser on it, does that make it an assault weapon? If it's got a magazine that's removable that holds more than 10 rounds, is that an assault weapon? I mean, is it a rifle that a 308? Is it a 223? Is it a 5.56? Is it a 7.62? Is it a shotgun? How do we even know what they're calling an assault weapon? And why is it called an assault weapon? Only criminals assault people, and they more than 90% of the time use handguns. So why are they calling them assault handguns? And what if it's knives, like it is in England, where they've banned guns? People are stabbed every day. Are they considered assault knives? Or what if somebody eats too many cheeseburgers? Does that make it an assault microwave? I mean, come on, this crap's ridiculous. As President Biden calls for new gun laws to make in the wake of mass shootings, and the federal ban in 1994 offers a reminder of how difficult it is to craft such prohibition. It's from the Wall Street Journal piece. It blows my mind that these idiots feel the need to try to ban something, but yet they won't even tell you what it is. Looks like by Cameron McWhirter and Zusha Elson. As the U.S. begins to make progress against COVID-19, a different tragedy has returned to the headlines. Mass shootings. On March 16th, a gunman killed 8 people at spas, massage parlors. A gunman killed 8 people at spas and massage parlors in the Atlanta area. Days later, another gunman killed 10 at a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado. With the tragedies, some have renewed calls for Democratic leaders to include President Joe Biden to authorize a new federal ban on assault weapons. We can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in this country once again, Mr. Biden said the day after the Boulder shooting. I got it done once when I was a senator. It passed. It was law for the longest time, and it brought down these mass killings. We should do it again, as Biden says. Little does he know it. Nothing was further from the truth. And most of the shootings that are taking place in our country are not mass shootings. Just because they're a shooting that killed 4 more people, if it's a gang shooting or if it's a family massacre, that's not necessarily a mass shooting. They want you to think. You got to listen to the rhetoric, people. They want you to think, oh my God, somebody shot up a school. We have to ban the gun. How about this? How about we try to figure out why these people are wanting to shoot up schools? Why don't we find out why they're shooting these people up? Maybe it has something to do with the fact that we're being Christian men are being called racist. Maybe it has to do with the fact that the government's trying to separate us on due to race and sexuality and gender confusion and all this other crap. Democrat Party paid a political price for the 1994 gun ban, losing its House majority in that fall's election for the first time in four decades. But the history of the federal assault weapons ban passed in 1994 after epic battle on Capitol Hill offers cautionary tale. Excuse me. COVID. Offers cautionary tale about how the difficulty of constructing an effective political acceptable ban. Mr. Biden, then powerful chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was a key supporter of the ban as part of a major anti-crime bill pushed by President Clinton. When Mr. Clinton signed the law in September 94, he touted it as a major victory over the National Rifle Association, declaring, we'll finally ban these assault weapons from our streets that have no purpose other than to kill. All guns have no purpose other than to kill, unless you're target hunting or shooting for sport or hunting to eat. That's the reason for a gun. Collectors, I know people that own guns that have never shot them just because they collect them. They like them. They like them hanging on the wall. Yet the Democratic Party paid a political price, losing its House majority in that fall's election for the first time in four decades. When the ban came up for reauthorization in 2004, it failed to get the necessary votes in Congress. Even though then-President George W. Bush, a Republican, said he would sign it if it came to his desk. Today, gun rights advocates and many gun control advocates view the ban as ineffective and politically destructive above all. These critics argue it didn't do what it was set out to do. Limit of sales in the weapons it proposed to ban. In fact, sales of weapons like AR-15-style rifles rose during the era of assault weapons ban and skyrocketed when it was lifted. It's the most popular sporting rifle there is. A 1994 law prohibited manufacture of 19 weapons by name, including Colt's AR-15. It banned semi-automatic weapons, guns that can quickly fire one shot after another with each squeeze of the trigger, that had detachable magazines and at least two military-style features, such as pistol grip or a bayonet mount. New magazines holding more than 10 rounds were also outlawed. Guns and magazines were already in circulation before the bans were grandfathered in. Those rules, which also applied to what the law called assault pistols, would have prohibited AR-style pistols used by 21-year-old Ahmet Alaiwi Elisa, a accused shooter of the Boulder, Colorado Boulder, but not the 9mm handgun used by the alleged Atlanta shooter, Robert Aaron Long, 21. Semi-automatic weapons with high-capacity magazines were used in about a quarter of the 170 mass shootings, in which four or more people were killed in a public place between 1966 and 2020. 2020, according to the Violence Project, mass shooting database funded criminology professors of Jillian Peterson and James Densley. The term assault rifle originated in the military to describe weapons used in combat. In the 1980s, gun makers produced semi-automatic versions of military weapons, embraced the term to market their firearms to wannabe warriors. By the end of that decade, however, gun control groups were using it to label guns they wanted banned, and the federal assault weapons ban passed in 1994. Both gun rights and gun control supporters believed it would severely limit civilian ownership of assault rifles. But that did not happen. Gun manufacturers quickly figured out how to make similar weapons without prohibited features, such as a bayonet mount. A frequent joke in the gun world that a ban greatly reduced the number of drive-by bayonettings prohibiting Colt's AR-15 by name didn't deter gun makers from selling AR-15-style weapons under different names. Colt called its post-ban rifle the match target. The post-ban guns looked a little different, and they were sold with 10-round magazines instead of 30-round magazines, but they still fired the same full bullets as fast as a shooter could pull the trigger. By 1999, multiple gun makers were producing more AR-15s than ever before. Before the 1994 gun ban, Americans owned approximately 400,000 AR-15s. According to the government estimates, today there are approximately 20 million AR-15-style weapons in the hands of private owners. Yet you don't have millions of people getting killed every single day. 20 million of them. And there's very few people using them for nefarious purposes. Do we ever wonder why that is? A 2014 report for the Justice Department found that the ban's effects on gun violence are likely to be small at best, perhaps too small for reliable measurement. That year, Congress let the ban lapse without much debate. Since then, sales of weapons prohibited under the ban have soared, spurred by periodic calls to ban them again in the past year by fears over the pandemic and rioting. Before 94, the ban approximately owned 400,000 AR-15s. The government estimates today there are about 20 million. That ought to tell you right there. There's 20 million guns on the street, and very few, if any, are used for any nefarious reasons. I mean, that right there tells you the gun ban didn't work. There's considerably more in the hands than there were during the ban. They never were able to stop them, and it's unacceptable that they're trying to take them away from people now. There's absolutely no reason for it. It's just an infringement on our Second Amendment rights, and it doesn't matter what gun we want to have. If we want to have a gun that shoots cannons, it shouldn't matter. I believe that the Second Amendment should not be infringed. That's what the law states plainly. And we'll get in further episodes, we'll get into some of the Second Amendment arguments at the Supreme Court level. We know that the city of St. Louis and St. Louis County filed a lawsuit this week on Missouri's sanctuary state federal nullification of gun laws, nullification of federal gun laws. Well, we're going to go through the law. We're going to read it word for word, discuss some of the meanings of it. So there's already been one lawsuit filed. I'm sure there'll be many more to come. Specifically, it's supposed to makes it unlawful for the federal government to enforce any federal gun laws in the state of Missouri. If they attempt to, they can be charged criminally and sued for up to $50,000. Any Missouri law enforcement that tries to help, unless it's a felony case, for any case other than a felony, then they're subject to the same lawsuit and jail time. So we're going to be going through that more often. A little deeper look into the Second Amendment in coming episodes. And can't wait to talk to you tomorrow. My email is rickylawson0814@gmail.com if you want to hit me up with comments or complaints, or if you want to argue with me, you're more than welcome. I'm willing to hear you out. If the more y'all listen, maybe I can get an 800 number and I can take live calls. That'd be even better, huh? Anyways, until then, thanks for listening. Forgive the minor hiccups. I'm still learning. This is only my 6th podcast. I'm doing the best I can. I hope it's working. I hope it's helping. Hope you're learning. Get in touch with your congressmen. Get in touch with your governors. Get in touch with your senators, Roy Blunt, Josh Hawley in Missouri, the federal level. We got to stop this yahoo going into the ATF. He's a tyrant. That's all there is to it. He cannot be in charge of our ATF. I personally think the ATF should be disbanded. I think they should be shut down, but that's just my personal opinion. But this guy, I don't even know. They got Merrick Garland in there, who's that guy's he's a monster. And this other guy in charge of the ATF, I can't think of his name, but man, he's horrible. The first thing he's going to do is ban any gun he can get his hands on. We can't allow that. We got the Second Amendment. We are licensed. We are free people. We have the right to own guns, the guns of our choice. As long as they're responsible with them, as long as you're training, train those kids, keep them safe. My kids knew how to break down guns, clean them 5-7 years old. They were shooting them by the time they were 9 or 10. To this day, they know just as much as I do, if not more. So until next time, this is For God and Country. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon. Thanks for listening to For God and Country. Stay tuned, more to come.